My name is Gil Fronsdal, and I'm the teacher here for this meditation group that meets here Mondays and Thursdays. And I have been a student of Buddhism for over 20 years, and about 23 years, I guess. And have my first years of practice, I actually started with TM, even before that. And then eventually got involved with first Zen Buddhism and was a Zen Buddhist student and was ordained as a Zen priest. And I practiced here in California at the San Francisco Zen Center, some of you might know, and also Tassajara. And then I went and practiced in Japan. And then I went to Southeast Asia and spent some time there practicing both as a layperson and as a monk in Thailand, Burma, and Nepal. And so that means, you know, I don't know what it means to all these years, but it means that I've taken it all very seriously. Quite a commitment behind it. I don't know what, you know, how much I've learned. But it certainly expresses a very deep level of commitment that I have and deep level of love that I have for Buddhist practice, and in particular for the mindfulness practice that I'll be instructing you in during these days. The tradition of mindfulness that I teach now comes from Southeast Asia and what I was introduced to when I was in Burma and in Thailand. And it's considered to be one of the oldest forms of Buddhist meditation. Pretty likely goes back to the Buddha himself. There are many different forms of Buddhism, and Buddhism changed and evolved as it went in India and as it went through the rest of the countries in Asia. And as it did, it developed in many different ways and certainly became more complicated and more evolved, more developed. And in some ways, depending on the tradition, became more and more religious, more and more institutionalized, and more and more complicated metaphysics and cosmology and deities and all kinds of things. But the earliest Buddhist tradition was very, very simple. And coincidentally, I believe, the simplicity, the egalitarian spirit of it, the anti-authoritarian spirit of it, the questioning inquiry that was part of it, the disinterest in metaphysical speculation that was part of the earliest Buddhist tradition, coincidentally, fits very well with a certain kind of modern Western attitudes of anti-authoritarianism, egalitarianism, anti-metaphysics, and all these things that we find, some of us, in the modern West. So I find tremendous inspiration from the earliest Buddhist tradition from which this meditation practice comes from. And then about 7 years ago, I was invited to come here to Palo Alto to lead a small meditation group that met over on Cowper. And there were about 15 people who were sat together once a week on Monday evenings without a teacher, and they would play tapes and Dharma talks. That group slowly grew, and then we moved here, and we have Monday evening, which is quite a large event. And now we have all of you who have come for the introductory course. And I'm quite kind of in awe that so many people would come to an introductory course, and it's grown to the level that, I mean, this is much bigger than the 15 people who was involved when we started. So it's very nice, and it's really a delight for me to be able to share something that I love so much. And I hope that if one of the things that you pick up during these 5 weeks is a little bit of my love or appreciation of awareness practice, of paying attention. There's a marvelous little story from the Japanese tradition, Zen tradition, of where it was customary often for Zen masters to do calligraphy. And they would do calligraphy and give the calligraphy to their students, and the students would hang it on the wall and collect it, and it was very special. And this wealthy, somewhat pompous fellow showed up with paper and ink and asked the Zen master to please write, in one word, the heart of what Buddhism is all about, the deepest teachings of Buddhism. So the Zen master wrote the word, the character for attention. And he handed him the paper, and he said, the man said, "Oh, you misunderstood. I was wanting the deepest teachings of Buddhism." And so he gave him a blank piece of paper, and the Zen master said, "Oh, okay." And so he wrote, "Attention, attention." And then the guy still didn't get it. And he said, "Well, no, you don't just seem to understand. I wanted the deepest, you know, the essential, you know, the deepest metaphysical, deepest truth of Buddhism." "Oh, I see." And he wrote again, "Attention, attention, attention." And it is, in some ways, the deepest teaching of Buddhism. And a lot of what Buddhism is about is learning to develop our attention. Buddhism is, there's a famous word in Buddhism called expression, ehe pasiko, which means come and see for yourself. And it's said in Buddhism that everything you need to know for your spiritual life or for your Buddhist spiritual life will come just from you paying attention by yourself. You don't have to believe anything, you don't have to read the Buddhist scriptures and, you know, believe a creed or change your behavior necessarily. All you have to do is develop very strongly your powers of observation, of presence, of attention. Attention, attention, attention. And in that sense, it doesn't make sense to talk about, you know, this is an Eastern practice or a Western practice. The mind of humans is basically the same. And our ability to pay attention, these mental factors of attention, of concentration, of awareness, of cognition, of compassion, of friendliness, these are kind of universal qualities of the human mind and the heart. And what Buddhist practice is really focusing on is developing something which is universal in all of us, the ability to pay attention, and developing it to a little bit stronger and perhaps more compassionate or friendlier pitch than exists for most of us in our normal everyday life. And as this mindfulness practice, this attention practice has come to America, you've seen it adapted in many different settings. And a lot of the settings are non-Buddhist, and it lends itself very well the practice lends itself very well to existing independent of Buddhism itself. And so I say that to underscore the idea that I'm teaching a Buddhist practice here, but I don't really care whether you pick up the Buddhist part of it. What I'm really concerned about is that you find some value in the mindfulness practice of it, which is not necessarily even Buddhist. It just happens to be housed in a Buddhist context. One of the places that's become most popular in America is in pain and stress reduction clinics. There's a fellow named Jon Kabat-Zinn who wrote some wonderful books, and he started a whole movement in American hospitals to use this mindfulness practice for people with very acute pain and a lot of stress in their life. So a lot of people will use it just because it's a wonderful technique for alleviating stress and becoming a little bit calmer and finding some more ease in their life. Other people will find that that it is a very powerful spiritual practice in its own right. And you can develop your spiritual capacities to a tremendous degree through this simply paying attention, by really a tremendous devotion, in a sense, to developing this capacity we have of paying attention. And in some degree, you know, everybody might think that, well, paying attention seems like a good idea. But the way many people live their lives, you would think that the opposite is more appealing, not paying attention. And a lot of people are experts in learning how to turn their attention away or turn their attention off from different aspects of their life. I suspect that a lot of the addictions that we find in our society, and America is a tremendously addictive society, is an attempt from people, in a sense, to turn off their attention from things which are painful or difficult, and to have some kind of other experience which isn't so difficult or painful. The movement away from pain and suffering in forms of denial and aversion and hiding and addiction are all movements away from wisdom and away from peace and equanimity. And the movement towards learning how to be present for our difficulties, how to have it bring careful, compassionate attention to it, is actually, from the Buddhist point of view, is the path of freedom. To turn away from our suffering is to turn away from our freedom, really. There's a wonderful cartoon that I saw some years ago, a Charlie Brown cartoon. And Charlie Brown is talking to Linus. And Charlie says, "Oh, So you think my father doesn't know how to fix his car? Well, just the other day we were driving and there was horrible clanky sound started coming out of the engine. And Linus said, "Oh, don't tell me. He stopped and fixed it." And Charlie said, "No, he turned up the radio." And I suspect that's what a lot of us do. We just do some way or other. We turn up the radio, some form of that. And it isn't that we're supposed to start paying attention to just our suffering, but our ability to pay attention, to be in the present moment, to anything that arises, is where our freedom is found. And we want to learn. We want to develop the ability to be openly present for both what's difficult in our life, the things we make ourselves uncomfortable, that we tend to kind of shut off from, and equally for our joys and the pleasures of our life. It's ironic that many times the mechanisms we have of escaping from the present moment, from paying attention, daydreaming a lot about the future, or planning the future, or thinking a lot about the past, or being in fantasy, or different things, or drugs, or television, or whatever it is that we use to get out of the present moment, to get away from ourselves. Those things also tune us out of the possibility of experiencing the beautiful parts of our life, the joyful part of our life. And it's an understanding of Buddhism that the most precious parts of human life can only be had if we're in the present moment to experience the present moment. Things like love and compassion and friendship, joy, are only experiences that are had when we're in the present moment. If you're thinking about tomorrow and planning tomorrow or remembering the joys of yesterday, there might be some little bit of happiness there, but that's not really the kind of thing which we find most precious. So the ability in which we can cultivate the strength of capacity to stay in the present moment, to that ability we develop an ability to allow for some of the more precious and beautiful parts of our human experience to flower, to be more present, ever present in our life. It occurs to me to say that partly because I have this quote I want to read. So 20 years ago, or 20, whenever I started practicing Buddhism, the average age of people who came to practice Buddhism was around 30, 20 years ago. And in the 20 years since, now it's 20 years since then, now the average age seems to be about 50. What?
Same people.
Same people, exactly. we're just kind of, moving along here. And then when we die, it's so much for Buddhism. I don't think that Buddhism is going to die out with us, because it's continued for a long time. But thinking about this, there's this quote by Carl Jung where he says, "Among all my patients in the second half of life, that is to say over 35, there has not been one whose problems in the last resort was not that of finding a religious outlook on life. It is safe to say that every one of them fell ill because they had lost what the living religions of every age had given to their followers. And none of them has been really healed who did not regain his or her religious outlook." Now, I don't know if you would agree with that, but it's my sense that it's true. At some point, most people will want to find some kind of religious outlook or perspective or context for their life. And if you don't find that, maybe I don't want to make any conclusions. It's dangerous to say anything. One of the beautiful things about the Zen practice that I studied is the Zen teachers like to say that they were kind of reluctant to teach anything, because when you teach something, it's kind of very easy to impose new ideas on top of people. You give them new ideas, and then they look at their life through those ideas. And really, and what we're trying to do, in a sense, is to clarify our vision so we can really see for ourselves, free from the veils of a lot of the concepts that we live our life in. And so that's why maybe I shouldn't say too much. And really just offer you the practice. And the practice just works itself. And the practice itself will begin, in a sense, helping you drop the veils of illusion, the veils of concepts that many of us live in. And the example that I like to give, I don't know if it's a good example, is we tend to, one of the veils of concepts that we kind of live in, see our life in, is in various ways in which we identify ourselves, forms of self-identification. I am a certain way. And we take on this idea, I am a certain way, and then we come to all these conclusions about how we are, because we have this idea of who we are. You know, I'm too thin or too fat or too dumb or too angry or too sad or, you know, whatever. And then we live with that, and assuming we are that. And one of the examples of those of us who are getting older, you can look back at the time when we were teenagers and think about some of the things we identified, some of the things that were so essential about who we had to be and how we had to present ourselves to the world. And it isn't a relief not to have that anymore. I used to be mortified by some of the things that... I remember to be seen with my father at the junior high school dance. He had the nerve to walk into the dance floor at the end of the dance, come and get me. I was mortified for days. You know, and I don't care anymore now. You know, that part of my... That's an identity that, like, somehow... you know, it was very important in that time. So to see ourselves more essentially as a being who is not limited by concepts and ideas, concepts of being a man or a woman, or old or young, or fat or young, fat or thin, or anything, but to allow our living, to allow our inspiration, our life, to flow out from the wellsprings within us, rather than being imposed from above, from the head, on concepts of shoulds and shouldn'ts, of what we should be. They have a saying in Buddhism, don't put a head on top of your head. You know. So so mindfulness practice is what I'm teaching you. Mindfulness practice can be said to work two ways. One way is basically is a practice of leaving ourselves alone. The meditation practice itself is a practice of learning to leave ourselves alone and not to add on top of our life the stress that comes with trying to be someone special, trying to fit all the shoulds and shouldn'ts that are an important part of our life, try to become a better person, a more likable person, a more responsible person, a more spiritual person. We add so many things that we try to do, and it kind of gets in our way. And a lot of what we're trying to do in mindfulness is simply to get out of our own way, and then see what wells up from the wellsprings of our heart, of our being, free of a lot of the conceptual conditioning that we have. The other way that mindfulness works, is more actually what mindfulness is by actually noticing more carefully what's happening in the present moment. To notice our conditioning, to notice the movements of our mind and our heart, to notice what's happening around us in our environment, to notice what's happening in our relationship with other people, not to be lost in our thoughts and our concepts, our fears, our fantasies, our projections about ourselves and others, but really to sense very deeply and very honestly what is going on. One of the synonyms for mindfulness practice is nothing else but a practice of honesty. It's learning to be extremely honest about who we are and what's going on in the present moment. Now, all these things I'm saying, maybe you think they're nice platitudes. I don't know what you think. I should ask you. But the challenge really becomes when you put it into practice. If those of you who want to try what the meditation practice I'll be teaching, the test will be, or the interesting thing will be for you to notice what happens with your ability to pay attention, your ability to be present in a friendly and compassionate way with yourself, for half an hour as you sit and do the meditation, what happens to your mind? Does it peacefully and serenely kind of stay put and stay, you know, stays with your breath or stays in the present moment? Most people, when they start doing a meditation practice, discover what's called the monkey mind. At which point, students will often come running back to the teacher and say, I can't do this practice. My mind is so crazy. I didn't know my mind was so busy and so crazy. And the teacher will say, congratulations. You've just reached the first stage of insight, first stage of realization. And that is to realize you have a mind. And the mind is out of control and very busy and has its own life and its own direction. And rather than being discouraged by that, it's actually the beginning of wisdom. And that's what we learn to work with. We learn to work with a mind which is has a will of its own, in a sense, and doesn't want to doesn't feel necessarily always so comfortable resting in the present moment, resting in our compassionate, wise heart. So we'll find out as you do this if that's the case or not. So enough for so in a couple of minutes we'll start with some instruction and some meditation. But I guess another piece of introduction to all this is more logistical. So this is a 5-week introductory course, and what happens is that I will progressively through these 5 weeks expand the instructions, building on the weeks before. So the idea in mindfulness practice is to cultivate an ability and a skill to bring mindfulness or awareness to all aspects of our life, to our all aspects of our inner life, to our feelings, our bodily experience, our emotions, our thoughts, and our external experience of life, our relationship to other people, our relationship to work and environment, and you know what we do around us. So in some ways, I'll kind of do this kind of progressively in 5 weeks. So it's somewhat useful to come all 5 weeks. If for some reason you don't come, there are tapes available from previous classes that I've done. So like if you miss, you know, next week where I'm going to talk about mindfulness of the body, how to include the bodily experiences in meditation, you could talk to Allison who's sitting here. And she can provide you with a tape for that, you know, any missed class you have. Allison also provides other things which are useful. She sells these round zafus, or round cushions, like this, or these kind of half moon shaped cushions like this here. And if you want to sit on the floor, it's really helpful to sit on a cushion. And these cushions are designed for sitting on the ground. And there's various places you can get them. You can get them, I think, at East West Books and various places. But Allison can get them, and usually cheaper than most other places. So you can put in an order with her. She takes an order and gets them. And but apparently her supplier is going on vacation. So you need to, if you want to order, you should order today after we're finished, and then she can bring it next week. Or the week after. Also, the tradition that that a Buddhism that I come from, that I'm involved in, puts a lot of stress on offering the spiritual teachings of meditation and the other teachings we have as freely to people as possible, to have kind of an open door, free attitude about making it available. Partly because that's the way it's was done in India and Southeast Asia for 2,500 years. And many of us who did go to Asia and practice were the recipients of freely given teachings. It was really, really remarkable in Asia. We would be the guests of the monastery or the temples, and whatever our needs were provided for. We didn't have to pay usually anything at all for being there. When I was in Burma, the best medical doctors in Burma would come visit us. Dentists would come visit us in the monastery if we had any needs. We didn't have to spend a cent because the whole country felt like we were kind of wanted to support people who were doing spiritual practice. So it was quite inspiring, and I feel tremendously grateful to the support I got in my practice. So we want to offer it as freely as we can here. And also because there's something about offering spiritual teachings freely, which I think is more in the spirit of the very practice itself. However, the other part of that is that it's not really possible for us to, in any kind of full-fledged way, to offer the teachings, to go around and be teachers and to do the different classes and workshops and retreats that we do, unless we're supported also. And so the means of support in the system is voluntary, freely given donations that people would like to make it possible. So that's how it's offered here, is that any of you who'd like, it's offered freely, nothing's expected of you, but it's only possible to allow this to continue and develop and grow if teachers like me are also supported. So we have two baskets out in the hallway there. And one basket is, it says rent on it. And that is, we have to pay the Quakers for the rent of this room. And if everybody put in a dollar each time, that would more than cover what we have to pay for the rent and our other little expenses we have. And the other basket, it says teacher dana. Dana is the word for generosity or donations. And that is if you feel inspired to want to help support continuing my ability to keep doing the teachings. And 95% of my livelihood comes from the donations I get from teaching. It keeps me very busy. I'm very involved. It's pretty much my whole life. So that's what it's about there. And I'm also inspired to make a comment about money. And that is, some years ago in the meditation center we have up in Marin, rather than offering it free a few times, they offered a six-week introductory course and they charged $60 for the 6 weeks. And the difference between charging and not charging was that even when the best teachers were giving the introductory course, it seemed like there was a big drop-off in the course of the weeks. But when we charged the $60 for the 6 weeks, there was no drop-off. It was exactly the same teaching. And there's something about, maybe in America, we value things through the monetary value that's placed on it. And I don't necessarily want to put a monetary value on it, but I want to just make a little comment about we should be a little bit careful about underlying assumptions about what has value and not value. And I hope you find value in this, even though it's, you know, offered freely. So, the meditation practice starts with taking a comfortable but alert meditation posture. So, I will give you some instructions about posture. I'll start with it for the people on the floor, and then I'll talk about for people sitting in chairs. One of the most important things to be able to do in meditation, it's not the most important, but it's very useful to be able to sit upright with an unsupported back, with a back that's held straight. And one of the easiest way to do that over a length of time is to have a firm foundation under you. And one of the firmest foundations is to have a tripod, 3 points of your two knees and your butt. So sitting cross-legged provides that kind of foundation. One of the most comfortable and nicest way of sitting cross-legged is to sit what's called the Burmese fashion, which is to sit with one foot in front of the other with both feet flat on the ground, if you can kind of see what I'm doing. So the ankles or the knees are not crossed. It's possible to sit in what's called half lotus or quarter lotus or full lotus position. But what happens with that, those classic meditation postures, there's a tendency of the body listening to one side. And then when you straighten yourself out, you're kind of stretching one part of the body more than the other. And if you keep doing that, it becomes a yoga teacher's nightmare, because you're stretching one part of your body more than the other. And it's actually more symmetrical and more balanced to have one foot flat in front of the other. So so you can see okay. Now, it's helpful if you can get your knees down. And to get your knees down on the floor, you want to have your sit up off the floor, like sitting on a cushion. That's why we sit on the cushion. By sitting up on a cushion, it allows the pelvis to rotate forward slightly and becomes easier for the knees to drop to the floor. And the higher you sit, the easier it is to get your knees down. In theory, everybody can get their knees down this way, except the problem is that if it's too high, cushions work like a slide, and you keep sliding off. So there's a kind of maximum limit there. But you can actually sit quite high. You can maybe put two of these cushions on top of each other or whatever. The way when you sit on these round cushions, the idea, they're designed for us to sit on the front third of them rather than smack down on top of them. And that's so that by sitting in the front curve, where it kind of curves down slightly, it kind of encourages the pelvis to roll forward. And if the pelvis rolls forward slightly, then it's a lot easier for the back to be held straight. It kind of accentuates ever so little this little curve in the lower part of your back. If you sit flat, like I'm sitting now, the tendency is for the lower back to collapse out. And if you sit that way for a long time, you're going to develop a bad back, probably. But by sitting up on a cushion, it's easier to have a nice curve or more of a better alignment in your spine. And if your spine is better aligned, it's easier to sit this way for a long time. So that's the idea about sitting cross-legged. It's just it's an easier way of sitting with your back straight. And then you want to sit in a way that your back is balanced. And one way to do it is you can kind of, when you first sit down, is you can rock back and forth a little bit. Forward and back and from side to side. And feel your weight on your sitting bones. And then until you can feel the weight balance there in the sitting bones, so you're not projected forward or backwards or to the side. You're balanced there. And then from that balance, then you see if you can, in a simple way, kind of maintain some balance of your weight up through the spine. So your center of gravity kind of goes through your spine when you're sitting here. The head goes squarely on top of the shoulders, not projected forward. And so we're often encouraged to tuck the chin back and down a little bit when you meditate. It's said that if you do that, that tends to control the wandering mind, though many of you won't believe it. Another way of doing this is to create a little bit of space between the last vertebrae and the skull. Just a little bit of openness and spaciousness right there can be helpful. And the tongue rests against the roof of the mouth. The mouth is kept closed. And in our tradition, for the most part, we sit with the eyes closed. So just allow them to close gently. The hands can be held in any posture that's more or less symmetrical. So it means that they can be on your knees, on your lap, up or down. The usual Buddhist way of having the hands, however, is to have the hands together in front of your stomach. So often kind of together like this or like this, somebody being held together. And it's nice to do there because there's a way, if you're sitting cross-legged on the floor, there's a way in which the legs come together here in the center and the arms come together in the center, and there's a kind of concentration of attention, a concentration of presence in this area around our navel, which is considered to be very useful and balancing for meditation practice. But anything that's comfortable you can do. If you sit the way that I suggested with your legs, both feet flat on the ground, and if you have your hands resting on your heels, on your ankles, sometimes that pulls the shoulders forward somewhat and puts some strain there. And if you feel some strain or some tiredness in your shoulders, what you might do is get like a towel or a little cushion or something and put it on top of your foot so you can have your hands resting higher so they're not being pulled down so much. And that can make it easier to sit a long time. Now, for the people sitting in chairs, some of the same principles apply. You want to sit in a way that's stable. And the usual instruction for this is to sit with both feet parallel to each other, slightly apart, with the feet planted flat on the ground, the soles kind of flat on the ground. And you want to sit in such a way that your knees are lower than your hips. If your knees are higher than your hips, or same level as your hips, there's a tendency of caving out in the lower part of the back. And you can also sit on a little cushion on a chair and have kind of the same kind of pushing the pelvis forward a little bit to create a little bit of strength, a little bit of curve in the lower part of your back so that you can be self-supporting. If you need to use a backrest because of back problems, it's fine to use that. But there is a kind of a relationship between our posture and our body and our inner life. And to the degree in which this practice or Buddhist practice is about becoming self-reliant in an inner way, it helps to find that self-reliance if we can be self-reliant in our posture. So it's best not to use a backrest if you can not use it. If you need to use a backrest and you have options, it's best to have support only in the lower part of your back, so your upper part of your back is self-supporting. If you have to use the backrest for the whole, that's fine. And some people will do the meditation practice laying down, because that's the only way they can do it. That's fine also. And again, when we're sitting on a chair, the hands can be in any you know, posture that's symmetrical. And the same thing with the head tucked down and back a little bit and the eyes closed. And that's kind of the basics of the posture. A couple of little points for people sitting on the floor is there are some alternative postures for sitting on the floor. And sometimes it's nice to be able to vary your posture so you don't kind of get your legs too tired. And that is, if you have one of these round cushions, you can put it upright like this and put it between your ankles and sit straight down on top of it and sit on your knees. And that's a quite comfortable way also to sit. And some people have benches. Anybody have a bench here? Yes, so the fellow back there sitting on a bench, which is a couple of different kinds of benches there. And that's an alternative way of sitting on your knees, and that's quite comfortable for some people. Any questions you have about the pot? Yes?
I've been trying to go to class to do the first stretch.
Yeah.
And after 20 minutes, my feet.
Okay. So the feet will often fall asleep. For people who are relatively new to the practice. Usually, within some time, and it varies from person to person, it can be weeks or a few months, it'll stop. What usually happens is that the legs, the circulation in your legs are not used to these new posture, and the circulation is being cut. And with time, it seems what happens is that the circulation finds other routes or compensates, and not a problem so much. Some people will find that it never stops. There are a few people who it just always happens. And I don't know why that is. Sometimes very small adjustments in posture can make a big difference. And you might want to, we can actually meet maybe afterwards tonight or some other night. And I can look at your posture. And sometimes small adjustments in how your feet are or your knees are can make a big difference in that way. Sometimes if you sit on something that's too hard, the hard surface can cut the circulation. And getting a mat, like Bernice here has this big black mat that she sits on when she comes. A few people have mats. And that actually can help quite a bit with circulation. And I think Allison sells those mats too, don't you? Occasionally, what it is not the blood being cut off, but rather the nerve being pinched. And then you know the difference because if it's the blood system, then once you break your posture and come out of your meditation posture and you kind of massage your foot a little bit and you know whatever you do, if it takes only 2 or 3 or 4 minutes for the sensation to come back, then it's blood. But if it takes 10 minutes or more for the circulation for the sensation to come back, then it's nerves, and that's very dangerous. And if you have any indication like that, that it takes longer than 10 minutes for the sensation to come back, you never want to sit that way again. You want to come and talk to me or talk to a teacher and see if you can find another way of sitting that doesn't pinch the nerve. Yes?
Do you ever find that people with lower back problems after, I'm assuming that I would have pain very quickly if I had pain right now on the floor. Does that sometimes also go away with time, or?
Some people it goes away, and some people it doesn't work. It depends on the kind of back injury it is. And for me, I have a kind of a little bit of a bad back. I injured my back some time ago, and one of the best things I can do for my back is actually to sit. And partly one of the things I do when my back hurts and I'm sitting is I relax the muscles all the way around my lower waist, and also relax the muscles in my thighs. And that release and this very aligned posture does something in my lower back that kind of relieves the spasming and kind of relieves the pain and kind of loosens things up. And certainly if you're careful about your posture and have a healthy aligned posture, I think for the most part I think it'll make things better. But it depends from person to person. So it's very important for you to pay attention and notice the difference of when it might be more damaging to sit that way and when maybe it might be helpful.
Do you recommend if somebody has a lot of pain after, say, 20 minutes to just shift postures? Or?
Yeah. I'll talk about physical pain next week and how the issues involved with meditation and pain. But certainly you're always welcome to change your posture, and if it's becoming uncomfortable and discouraging or potentially damaging, change your posture, if you're sitting cross-legged, then switch this position or switch up into a chair or whatever. Yes?
Why is symmetry important?
Symmetry is important because if you stretch one part of your body more than the other, you tend to become imbalanced, and it becomes more and more. And then it could be that the joints start wearing different ways. And
how about in your hands? Where your feet placement?
Meaning?
You hold your hands in a way that's not symmetric like this.
Oh.
You said hold your hands symmetrically.
Oh, no, what I meant symmetrically, I didn't mean like, that. I don't know, that kind of minute. I don't know. I never gave much thought about my hands that way. But I meant just to, so they're just doing the same thing from the left side of the body and the right side of the body. So meaning that if you have one hand, if you have a right hand on your right thigh, have your left hand on your left thigh. Don't have it, somewhere else. Just do the same thing with both hands. Does that make sense?
Gil, I listened to one of your tapes on, like, tonight, and you mentioned how the women in Thailand sat. I listened to it on the tape and I couldn't see visually.
It's very unsymmetrical, the way the women in Thailand sit. And I think it has something to do with the cultural ideas of modesty or whatever. Because, for a woman to sit cross-legged, it's like women, riding horses in the old days, right? They didn't ride horses like men because that was rather immodest. And so they would sit women style with both legs on one side. Isn't that kind of right? So maybe it's the same thing in Thailand with meditation posture for women. So rather than sitting cross-legged, which is the way the men sit, the women sit with one leg behind them, like this, and one leg kind of in front. And if you get good at that, do it this way, you can actually take your back foot and bring it around under your butt, and then you kind of sit on that. And lots of women in Thailand get enlightened sitting in this posture.
How about bringing the back foot out to the side and pointing it like toward the side?
Some people do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. There are various ways of sitting, and you get very loose. So you get really loose in your hips, and eventually you can sit really well and that way. And the posture. There's nothing magical about the posture in our tradition. It's just a pragmatically, this is a useful way of sitting. Any posture actually is fine, because what we're developing is not posture, it's not a yoga practice, is we're developing the ability of our attention, the ability to be aware and mindful, our ability to be present for what's going on in our life. And that's not dependent on posture so much. Does this all make sense? So let's do a little meditation. I'll kind of guide you, and then afterwards I'll tell you what you did. So, and if some of you have been sitting on the floor for a few minutes, you might want to stand if you feel it's helpful. Just stand for 30 seconds, or all of you if you want to stand and just... Would you mind getting me a glass of water? take as comfortable and alert posture that you can. And gently close your eyes. And then take a moment simply to feel yourself sitting in your place, sitting on your cushion, or on the floor, or on your chair. To be in the present moment, generally, means to be in a place, to be here at this place. So you might just start just arriving, feeling your connection to this place, the weight against your cushion, chair. And then it's often nice in the beginning of a period of meditation to take a few deep breaths. And as you breathe out, to relax and let go, settling into your body. Two or three times. And then letting your breath, we do this kind of meditation. There's no particular idea about how we're supposed to be breathing. Any way that you happen to be breathing is fine. And then also, at the beginning of a meditation session, it can be useful to just scan through your body, and if there's any obvious places of tension that can be relaxed easily, you might just soften that part of your body. So you might start, you know, with your forehead. Sometimes the jaws can be softened. Sometimes you can send a little softness or relaxation to your shoulders. And perhaps to your stomach, letting your stomach be soft and relaxed. Having the stomach hang out, not holding the stomach in. And then feeling your whole body, or feeling whatever sense of your body you have right now. A lot about mindfulness practice is about being embodied, being in a body. Sensing and feeling your body from the inside. And then as part of your body, within your body, become aware of your breathing. Becoming aware of the sensations in your body that inform you that you're breathing. The sensations of expansion and contraction, of pressure, tautness, looseness, warmth, coolness, movement. And if you have trouble finding or sensing your breath, you can put your hand on your stomach and just feel the maybe rising and falling of the stomach as you breathe. And the breath is central to mindfulness meditation. It's kind of our guide or friend or help helping us develop our ability to be in the present. We develop our ability to be present by being present with the breath, our breathing. So very softly and gently, let your awareness and your breathing be connected. In other words, breathe consciously, breathe with awareness. As you breathe out, letting yourself relax. Letting go of your thoughts and concerns. And just resting with experience of breathing. And when you find that you lose touch with the breath, perhaps you wander away in thoughts and concerns, let go of your thoughts and gently come back to your breathing. And it's pretty natural for the mind to wander away in thoughts and concerns. You don't have to fight it or judge it happening. Whenever you notice the mind wanders away, then gently and softly bring your attention back to your breathing. And as you breathe in and out, it can be helpful to ever so softly, the most gentle, soft whisper of a note, label the experience. So as you breathe in, you might just very simply say in. And as you breathe out, you can say out. And just very softly, mostly what you're doing is feeling the breath, sensing the experience of breathing. And then using your thought, your label, so your thought thinking is involved in a simple way with the breathing, rather than being free to wander away. You don't need to be concerned about doing it right or wrong, or that your experience of yourself right now is right or wrong. You don't need to be concerned that whatever is happening for you shouldn't be happening. The spirit of mindfulness is to allow things to be as they are. And then within that great allowance, bringing ourselves back to the breathing, resting with the breath, when the mind wanders away, then gently bringing it back over and over again, resting with the in-breath and the out-breath. Notice when the mind wanders away in thought, and then gently bring it back to the breathing. And notice when you're involved in thinking about what's happening, thinking about how the meditation is going, commenting on it. And when you notice that you're commentating, thinking and being involved in concerns, with as much kindness and care as you can, let go. And let yourself simply trust the breath. Let the breathing breathe you. If something occurs in your experience that makes it difficult to be with the breath, strong physical sensations, strong emotions, strong concerns, continue to be with the breath, but breathe into those difficulties. Breathe with them. Let the breath include those strong and difficult experiences. So you're still grounded in your breath, But you're not fighting or struggling against the difficulty. You can be there for it also. Simply remembering to come back to the present moment, come back to the breathing. No need to worry. Just simply for another minute or two, sit here consciously breathing, resting with the breath. And then at the end of a sitting, it's nice to take a deep breath or two again before you open your eyes. In many ways, the mind is kind of like a spring that can be wound up. And as we live our lives, our reactions are to the life around us and reactions to life within us, it's kind of like winding up the spring. And so many of us, at the end of a day, for example, the end of a lifetime, whatever, have often wound the spring quite tightly. And what meditation allows, in part, is to allow us to stop the winding up, and allow ourselves to unwind, to relax. And it's not something magical. You don't have to be consciously relaxing. All you have to do is stop winding the spring. Much of our life is made is reactive. We're kind of we like things, we don't like things, we want things differently. There's shoulds and shoulds, there are fears and concerns and anxieties, and all those things are kind of, if we're actively involved with those things, it's kind of like we're tightening the screw of concern. Being with the breath is kind of a neutral place to be, and just coming back and letting the attention develop itself in the present moment in the breathing, in this neutral place, has a tendency of pulling the mind away from all these kinds of concerns which tend to tighten up the spring. And if we're not concerned in those, then they kind of relax to some degree. A lot of what... So mindfulness of breathing does various things. One of them it does, it helps us unwind, kind of leave ourselves alone, to become a little bit calmer. And as we become calmer, our ability to pay attention becomes better. And the goal of mindfulness practice is not to become tremendously calm. Some people think meditation is all about becoming calm or getting completely peaceful or completely filled with joy or rapture or tranquility or enlightenment or something. It's not really. The point of mindfulness meditation, at least, is to develop an ability to see very clearly and honestly and with equanimity and friendship what is happening in the present moment. And we're not trying to chase calm. However, some modicum of calm is very helpful. If we're just kind of lost in the monkey mind, then it's very difficult to pay attention to anything. Now, how many of you discovered the monkey mind sitting here these 10 minutes? Congratulations. You reached the first stage. And the monkey mind is the mind that just wants to just bounces all over the place. And just the part of the analogy of the monkey is apparently monkeys are constantly grabbing at things, and they always want something new. They grab one thing and then they want something else, and then they want something else. And maybe the mind sometimes is like that. It can never stay very settled on one thing. So the degree in which the mind has a strong habit of wandering off into concerns and preoccupations, to that degree, we're not really free. And by coming back and being with the breath, coming back over and over and over again, we begin softening those habits. We begin weakening the habits to be distracted and kind of wander off into these preoccupations. So just the breath is very important for that, in that way. So that's what I encourage you to do for the next week in your meditation. Just do breath meditation. Just be with the breath in a very simple way. And don't try to make anything happen in your meditation. Don't try to make yourself calm. Don't try to make yourself, anything. Just simply sit and close your eyes and just simply try to be with your breath the best you can. Follow the breath, rest with the breath, and allow whatever's going to happen on its own. It's best in meditation to have a very allowing attitude about yourself and about your experience, to allow whatever's going to happen. The mindfulness practice that we do, this is kind of a subtle but very important point. It's not about what your experience is, but it's about how you hold your experience, how you relate to it. So it means we're not trying to manipulate or change our experience of ourselves or our life. We're not trying to push something away or change who we are. We're rather relating to it with a more open-handed and friendly way, a more allowing way. Because usually we relate to things through our likes and our dislikes, or pushing away or holding on to things. And it's actually very radical to not to relate to things by either pushing them away or holding on to them in all kinds of gross and subtle ways. And so in mindfulness practice, we're simply trying to find this allowance, this open-handedness, this generosity of spirit to what's happening in the present moment. So, for example, if you have a headache and you sit down, rather than trying to meditate in order to get rid of the headache, we're trying to bring our attention to the headache and to attention to our reactions to the headache to see if we can allow it to be there without these kind of painful reactions of aversion and trying to change things and disappointment and despair that you might have. And maybe that doesn't sound like a very interesting thing to do, but you'll find if you do this meditation that it's actually quite transformative. No matter what the experience is, whether it's joyful or difficult, to develop an allowing attitude towards it. And you see your attitude, your relationship to the experience is more important than what's happening. So as you sit, just sit with an allowing spirit. Whatever happens is fine. You're just going to come back and be with your breath whenever you remember. And if you forget for 5 minutes, no need to beat yourself up or be discouraged. Just when you happen to remember, come back. Come back as often as you can, and when you come back, try to rest there with the breathing as best you can. Then what we'll do next week is we'll expand the instructions, because in mindfulness practice, we don't just only stay with the breathing, but we learn how to bring careful attention to the other parts of our life. So any questions or any comments about what that meditation was like? Sorry? What time of day? Preferable, usually for most people, is early in the morning. Partly because early in the morning you're less likely to be disturbed. You're less likely to have other things happening, like getting in the way. It's very useful when you do a daily meditation practice to choose a time of day where you're likely to do it every day at the same time. What's very important for meditation practice is to have some commitment to doing it every day. Because if you don't have some modicum of commitment, the tendency for people is to meditate only when they either feel really good or when they feel lousy. And the point of meditation is simply to allow ourselves to bring our whole life into the sphere of awareness, into the sphere of meditation. Not to be kind of picking and choosing, but allow everything to be integrated within it. And if you have some commitment to sit every day at the same time, over the months and years, much of our life begins passing through there. It's outside of our preferences. So the early morning works best for most people. Some people prefer other times. It's for you to find out. How long to sit? I recommend, those of you who are new to meditation, you might start with just 15 minutes a day. And then each week of this introductory course, you can add 5 minutes. And when you get to, say, half an hour, then you can just decide whether maybe that's enough, and maybe half an hour a day is long enough, or if you feel you like it, you can sit more, 35, 40 minutes or an hour. Some people find it's very nice to do two meditations a day, to do one early in the morning and to do one after work, for example, or before going to bed. And I've done both. In different times of my life, I kind of preferred one over the other, the late afternoon one or the early going to bed one. You'll find that the benefits of meditation practice kind of creep up on you. Some of them might be obvious to some of you right away, and some of them kind of creep up by allowing it to kind of through the continuity of it. You do it every day, it's kind of like slow kind of skill and slow ability gets developed, and slow level of kind of presence and calm that begins infusing the rest of your life. That's quite nice. It's best to do it in a place where you're not going to be disturbed. Some people like to choose some place in their house that's designated their meditation spot. They don't do anything else in that spot. So the associations with that spot is meditation. So when they go there to sit, that's what their associations are like. Some people want to know, how do you know when 15 or 20 or 30 minutes is over? And you can get a little timer. It's probably nice to have a silent timer. It goes off after your designated time. Some people like to do meditation cassette tapes, where you tape 15 minutes of silence, and then at the end of the 15 minutes of silence, you hit a bell. And then whenever you meditate, you stick your tape in the cassette player, and it plays all the silence for 15 minutes, and then at the end of silence, you hear this, to get up. So there's different ways. So any comments or questions about actually how it was to sit here for the 10 minutes?
Yeah. When you say that we should observe our breath, you mean more that we should observe our feelings, or I mean, how does our thinking relate to that? Should we think about our breath
yes.
or nothing at all?
Yeah. You don't need to think about your breath. It's what it is. It's more like a sensory awareness exercise. So what you want to do is sense the sensations involved with your breathing. So I try not to use the language of watching or observing, because for some people that tends to suggest a kind of dualistic relationship. You're the watcher up here watching this experience down there, the breath. But rather, it's more the sense of it is you're inside the breath and you're sensing and feeling. It's like you had a masseuse inside of you. You know, and you kind of, you know, it's very nice to feel a masseuse kind of massaging your body, right? And you're right there and you feel it and you sense it. You don't have to think about it, that, you know, what this person's doing. You're just there receiving it, right? And so the same thing, you just receive and sense and feel the sensations involved with breathing. If you feel the breath coming in through your nostrils, you might sense and feel the breath going back and forth, the tingling or the warmth and the coolness. If you feel the breath in your chest, you might feel the expansion and contraction, the movement of the chest. You might feel, you know, the various sensations of hardness and pressure and looseness. Same thing for the stomach. You feel the movement and whatever's happening there. So does that speak to you, or does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, the thinking will go on anyway. So making a subtle mental note is very helpful. You just kind of in, out, or some people say rising, falling, rising for the rising of the torso and falling for the out-breath. Just saying a small mental note, it's kind of like using the thinking part of the brain to help you stay present, rather than giving it a chance to kind of do something else that takes you away. But if you're thinking about something and thinking is in the background, is not distracting you from the breath, and you can actually stay quite sensitive to what's going on with the breathing, just leave the thinking in the background, don't worry about it. What?
Each time I start to think about something particular, or rather well,
yeah,
the thought comes, and the mind sort of starts developing.
And you lose touch with the breathing.
Right.
So when you notice that, just notice that's happened, and then let go of it and come back to your breathing. And don't come back to the breathing mechanically, like, you know, like a duty, like this is what I have to do, but rather come back to it with interest. And come back with interest to the breath, as if the breath is this organic, intimate part of who you are. And you're going to enter this organic, intimate part and sense and feel it with interest. So that way, if you're not interested in the breathing to some degree, it's very difficult to stay present. Yes?
What do you do if you start to fall asleep? I find my mind starts to wander.
If you start falling asleep, you can do a few things. One is, pragmatically, you need more energy at that point in your meditation. And one way to get energy is to sit up straighter, take a more straighter, more alert, energetic posture. And maybe that's all it takes to wake up. If you're still very sleepy, it can also be helpful to open your eyes and meditate with your eyes open. And some people actually will meditate, or even your eyes closed, will meditate in front of a light or in front of an open a daylight window. And they get this light even through their closed eyes. And that can bring some alertness. If none of that works, and you're dead tired, you might take a nap. The other thing you might do is, there's some various things you can do. Walking meditation, which at some point near the end of this course, I'll talk about walking meditation. And it's more difficult to fall asleep then. but you know, interesting, the purest, so, you know, no one should be a purist, but the purest thing you do from the point of view of mindfulness practice is to allow it to happen with careful awareness. You bring your awareness to the sleepiness, and you explore where is the sleepiness in the face. Where do you feel heaviness in the eyes, or sandpaper in the eyes, or heaviness in the shoulders and your cheeks, and where is actually what sensations in your body are telling you you're sleepy, and then you bring your careful attention to that. The simplest definition of the month for me, for mindfulness practice, it's allowing all things to be while remaining consciously aware of it. So in terms of sleepiness, I mean, for that definition, it's allow yourself to be sleepy, but bring careful attention to what that's like. Become a connoisseur of sleepiness. Like you're a scientist who's discovered from the inside what sleepiness is really like. Not to push it away or make it different, but just to really just be the, you know, spirit of discovery. It's partly a trick, because if you bring that kind of interest to sleepiness, you tend to wake up. But also it's really the spirit of the practice. That kind of investigation, that kind of bringing attention to what's happening. And that'll make more sense later on as we go along. Yes?
I don't know. Why do you think that our attention to what's happening is more important than the actual thing?
That our attention is more important than?
You said a few minutes ago, if I understood you properly, that our attention to what's happening around us, ourselves, is more important than those.
Oh, you know, not that exactly. In the context of doing this practice, and this practice is not all of life, but in the context of this practice, what's more important is I think what I said was not this, your attention, yes, but also your relationship to what's happening is more important than what's happening. So, for example, if your mind is really scattered when you sit to meditate, you don't have to kind of have an unscattered mind so much, but you want to have a relationship to that that's allowing. Not feeding it, but not criticizing it either. Not indulging, but not pushing away. So the balance point, the midpoint of equipoise that we're trying to find in mindfulness is this natural state of being that is not reactive. And the usual way, kind of generic ways in which we react is we push things away or we grab hold of things. And so if that's the habitual ways of being in the world, we lose our freedom. And the example I like to give is, you know, if you're walking down the street and you pass an ice cream store, and the next thing you know, you're walking down the street and you're holding an ice cream cone, you've reacted. You know, or someone cuts you off on the freeway, and before you know it, you know, you flip them off. And then you say, oh, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't have done that. That was the police. You know. Then many of us are really have very strong reactive ways of responding, and it can be very, very subtle movements of the mind. It can be very gross. When we react, we're not free. If we can find that midpoint of equipoise, it doesn't automatically react and allows the things to be there in a sense. From that, it allows us a chance to respond with wisdom and understanding and freedom. So it isn't that we're supposed to be complete zombies, you know, and not respond at all. But we want to respond rather than react, is the teachings in Buddhism. So the training in meditation is a training to become comfortable and trustful in this natural state of being that doesn't have to react to anything, doesn't have to be anything and be anything for anybody, doesn't have to protect ourselves from anything, doesn't have to prove anything. And that's why just simply allows all things to be without making a deal out of it. And that's very powerful to do that. It's actually enlightening if you do it well enough. Someone else, yes?
I travel a lot on business, and sometimes the only opportunity I would have really for meditating would be on an airplane or a train or something that's actually rather noisy.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of meditating in that kind of environment?
It's fine. This will become clear as we go along, and maybe I shouldn't say it the first night, it may confuse you, but in this mindfulness practice that I'm teaching, there's no such thing as a distraction, because what it is, we're learning to pay attention to whatever is happening in our experience, whatever is predominant. Actually, what we say is the meditation practice is to pay attention to whatever is predominant in our experience. So if it's a noise, it's not a distraction from being with the breath. It's just something else to pay attention to, if it's predominant. And some of the meditation monasteries I was in Asia were probably noisier than any plane you're ever going to be traveling on. There was one meditation hall that was in the lobby of the main headquarters for one of the main orders of Thai Buddhism. And the telephone is ringing, and people are running back and forth and yelling. And there in the back of that lobby were these people doing a meditation practice. And they didn't think it was a problem, the heavenly sounds and noises. And it's very hard to find a silent meditation center in Asia. Almost every meditation center, I think every meditation center I found in Asia had the village loudspeaker blaring away. And it was not very good quality speakers either. It'd be scratchy sound. They're playing all these pop tunes endlessly. The amount of times I heard Madonna sing. Oh, no, it wasn't her song. Luckily, it was in Burmese. I didn't have to hear the same words over and over again. And but, you know, the tune was there. So noises and things like that aren't a problem. And it's actually, in some ways, it might, might serve you really well to develop the capacity to develop some stability and calm and presence in that environment. Can do it anywhere.
Would you be following the noise instead of following the breath?
Can you come to the next 5 weeks, 4 weeks? And you'll understand better as we go along. But for now, for this next week, just stay with your breath. Cultivate as much with it. The breath is really the center and the heart of the sitting practice. So if you cultivate that really well, you'll go a long ways. And this course, you know, is really designed best if you really put this into practice during the week. If you sit every day and come back with questions and concerns, and we build as we go along. Is there anything else I should be saying? Some of you have been here at these courses before. Have I left anything out that I should have said the first day?
Can I talk a little about exercise?
What should I say?
Oh,
there are kind of exercises like yoga exercises you can do to help stretch. And in order to sit cross-legged on the floor, what needs to stretch the most is the hips. You want to open your hips more. You're not supposed to loosen your knees so much. So do hip opening exercises and hamstrings and all kinds of yogic things. And actually, we have a yoga class here Monday evenings, second and fourth Monday of the month at 6:30. I can't think of anything more to add. Maybe that's enough then. It's 8:30. So, thank you for coming. And really, my job is not only to share with you something I love, but it's also to try to be as helpful as I can to make it clear and understandable and work with you with any kind of difficulties or confusions you might have about the practice. So please ask me or come and find me and we can talk. So please have a nice time. Thank you.